When it's my turn, I am given 4 boxes of sardines, stamped in France, 2 vegetable sausages wrapped in cellophane, a package of biscuits enriched with vitamins, 2 slabs of Swiss chocolate, some smoked lard, and a half pound of lump sugar. 4 steps further on, another attendant piles onto my already encumbered arms a waterproof ground sheet, a pair of socks, and a pair of woolen gloves. At the door, one more item is added, a cloth packet inscribed Field Kit, First Aid. In the falling rain, I rejoin my group, which is clustered around an officer crouched on the back of a truck. He is well protected in his long coat of grey-green leather, and seems to be waiting for the entire company to assemble. When he judges that everyone has arrived, he begins to speak. He talks so quickly that I have a hard time understanding what he says. You will be leaving this billet to convoy several military trains to a more advanced post. You have just been issued with supplies for 8 days, which you will now include in your equipment. You will assemble in 20 minutes. Now get ready. Quickly, silent with anxiety, we return to our quarters and gather together our possessions. As I fasten my pack to my back, my neighbor in the next bed asks, "How long will we be gone?" "Don't know. I just wrote to my parents and asked them to send me some books. The PO will forward your package." At that moment, Hals, my enormous friend, hits me across the back. "At last we'll see some Russians," he shouts, grinning sardonically. I sense that he is trying to build up his nerve. In reality, everyone feels considerable emotion. Despite our perfect innocence, the idea of war terrifies us. Once more we find ourselves standing in the courtyard in that damned rain. We are each given a registered Mauser and 25 cartridges. I don't know if it's a reaction to receiving these arms, but I notice that everyone is turning pale. Certainly we can all be excused for this, no one in the company is more than 18. I myself won't be 17 for another 2.5 months. The lieutenant notices our confusion, and to raise our spirits reads us the latest Wehrmacht communique tilde copyright. Von Paulus is on the Volga, von Richthofen is near Moscow, and the Anglo-Americans have suffered great losses in their attempts to bomb the cities and towns of the Reich. Our officer seems reassured by our answering cries of Sieg Heil. The entire 19th Company stands at attention in front of the flag. Laus, our Feldwebel, is there, also helmeted and fully equipped. At his side he carries a long automatic in a black leather sheath, which gleams in the rain. We are all silent. The order to move out sounds like the abrupt blast of an express train's whistle, Achtung! Richtsam! Rouse! In threes, we leave the place which was home during our first army experiences. We cross the stone bridge for the last time, and set off down the road which brought us here a month and a half ago. I look back several times at the imposing grey mass of the ancient Polish castle which I shall never see again, and would have succumbed to melancholy if the presence of my comrades had not raised my spirits. We arrive at Białystok, a sea of green uniforms, and march to the station. Part 1. Russia, Autumn, 1943. Towards Stalingrad, Minsk, Kiev, Baptism of Fire, Kharkov. We were standing beside a long railway convoy. We had been ordered to stack our guns on the tracks and take off our packs. The time was somewhere between 12 noon and 1 o'clock. Laus was munching on something he had taken from his pack. His face, although scarcely attractive, had grown familiar to us, even reassuring. As though his action were some kind of signal, we all took out our food, some immediately devouring the equivalent of 2 meals. Laus noticed this, but contented himself with a brief comment. "All right, go ahead, gobble it all down. But there won't be another distribution before the week is over." Although we all felt as if we'd eaten only half of what we really needed to assuage our giant appetites, we also felt a little bit warmer. By this time we had been waiting in the cold for more than 2 hours, and it was beginning to get the better of us. We tramped up and down, joking and stamping our feet. Some, who had paper, wrote letters, but my fingers were too numb, and I contented myself with observation. Trains loaded with war materiel were continuously passing through the station, which had turned into a vast bottleneck, with cars backed up for at least 600 yards. Everything seemed very badly organized, with convoys moving out, only to be shuttled onto other sections of track, where other companies brought from God knows where were being kept waiting as we were. People were always moving out of the way to let a train go by, only to see it a few minutes later headed in the opposite direction. What a mess. The train we were leaning against seemed to have been immobilized for eternity. Perhaps it would have been better if it had never left. To give myself some exercise, I hoisted myself up as high as the air holes in the carriages. Instead of cattle, the train was filled with munitions. By this time we had been in the station for 4 hours, and felt frozen. It grew colder as it grew dark, and to kill time we plunged once more into our provisions. Although it was already quite dark, traffic continued, dimly lit. Laos was beginning to look as though he had had enough. With his cap pulled down over his ears, and his collar turned up, he was tramping up and down for warmth. He must have covered at least 10 miles. We had formed a small group of friends from Chemnitz, which wasn't to break up until much later: Lenzen, Olensheim, and Hals, three Germans who spoke French as badly as I spoke German, Morven, an Alsatian, Euterbic, an Austrian, as dark and curly as an Italian dancer, who eventually dissociated himself from our group, and me, a Franco-German. Among the six of us, we were making progress in both languages, except for that damned Euterbic, who never stopped humming Italian love songs under his breath. These plaintive melodies sounded out of place and totally foreign to ears more accustomed to Wagner than to Italian composers, especially those lamentations of an abandoned Neapolitan swain. Hals had a watch with a luminous dial which informed us that it was already 8:30. We felt sure that our departure was imminent, but they were not going to leave us on the station platform for the night. But that is how it turned out. After another hour, several men unpacked sleeping rolls and stretched out as best they could if possible on some raised surface, for a little protection from the damp. Some even had the temerity to sleep under the train, hoping that it wouldn't start rolling. Our sergeant had settled on a pile of railway baggage and lit a cigarette. He looked worn out. We simply couldn't accept the idea of a night out of doors. It seemed impossible that we would be left where we were. We knew that the departure whistle would blow soon, and that all the idiots who hadn't had the patience to wait would have a fine time packing up their bedrolls in a hurry. As it turned out, we would have done better to imitate them and gain 2 hours' sleep. 2 hours later we were still sitting on the cold stones of the roadbed. It was growing steadily colder, and a fine rain had begun to fall. Our sergeant was busy building himself a shelter with the railway baggage, not at all a bad idea. When he covered this over with his waterproof sheet, he was completely sheltered old fox. We now felt compelled to find ourselves some shelter too. We couldn't move too far from our weapons, but we left them nonetheless, with their barrels in the air, open to the rain, expecting a royal dressing down later on. The best places, of course, were taken by this time, and the only thing we could think of was to shelter beneath the railway cars. It had certainly occurred to us to try to get inside, but the doors were held shut with wire cables. Full of complaints, we crawled into our disquieting and altogether relative shelter. The rain blew in sideways after us, and we were furious. Later on, this anger made me laugh. As best we could, we arranged some degree of shelter from the rain. This was my first night in the open air, and needless to say, I never shut my eyes for more than 15 minutes at a time. I can remember long periods of staring at the huge axle that served as the roof of my bed. Through my exhaustion, it often seemed to be shifting, as if the train were about to move. I would wake with a start to find that nothing had changed, fall back again into a half sleep, only to be startled back into wakefulness once again. At the first glimmer of daylight we left this chance resting place, stiff and numb, looking like a gang of disinterred corpses. We fell in at 8 o'clock, and marched to the embarkation platform. Hals remarked several times that we could perfectly well have spent another night at the castle. None of us as yet had any idea of the dispiriting necessities of military life in wartime. This had been our first night out of doors, but we were destined to spend many others which were far worse. For the moment, we were train guards. Our company had been divided among three long convoys of military materiel, two or three to a car. I found myself with Hals and Lenson on a flat car which carried airplane wings marked with a black cross, and other parts covered by canvas. These were supplies destined for the Luftwaffe. According to the inscriptions we had been able to read, they came from Ratisbon, and were going to Minsk. Minsk, Russia. Our mouths suddenly went dry. We were pursued by bad luck. We were stuck on an open car, the rain had turned to snow, the unbearable cold was intensified by the motion of the train. After due consideration we ducked under the tarpaulin which covered a large DO-17 engine. This maneuver cut the wind, and by clinging together we managed to achieve a semblance of warmth. We stayed there a good hour, roaring with laughter over nothing. The train was rolling along and we hadn't the slightest idea what was happening outdoors. From time to time we could hear trains going in the other direction. All of a sudden, Lenson thought he heard a voice shouting above the noise of the wheels. Carefully he stuck his head out of our shelter. "It's Laus," he said calmly, turning back to us and pulling the canvas down again. 10 seconds later, the canvas was ripped back to reveal the sergeant fuming with rage at the sight of our three happy faces. Laus, wearing a helmet and gloves, looked very much on the job. His face and coat were powdered with snow, like the rest of the train, whose long profile joggled and swayed behind him. The air rang with a loud "Achtung!" But the spasmodic motion of the train prevented the order from being executed with its customary stiff precision. The scene which followed was worthy of burlesque. I can still see that great teddy bear Hals, swaying from right to left as he tried to maintain a rigid posture. As for me, my long coat had caught on one of the numerous sections of airplane engine, which made it impossible for me to straighten up. Laus was no better than we were at maintaining a dignified attitude. Finally, beside himself with exasperation, he braced himself with one knee against the floor. We followed his example, and from a certain distance we might have been taken for a quartet of conspirators whispering secrets. In fact, I and my companions were receiving a magisterial dressing down. "What the hell do you think you're doing under there?" Laus shouted. "Where in God's name do you think you are, and what do you think you're supposed to be doing on this train?" Hals, who had a spontaneous nature, interrupted our superior. He said that it was impossible to stay outside the canvas because the cold was so bad, and that anyway there was nothing to look at. It would seem that by making these observations, Hals was demonstrating a total lack of objectivity. Like an enraged gorilla, the sergeant seized our comrade by the collar and shook him violently, with a torrent of abuse. "I'll make my report. At the first stop I'll have you sent to a disciplinary battalion. This is nothing less than abandoning your post. You could get the firing squad. What if a car had blown up behind you? You couldn't have warned anyone from that hole of yours." "Why?" Lenson asked. "Is a car going to blow up?"
"Shut up, idiot. There are terrorists all along the line, ready to risk anything. When they don't blow the trains right up, they throw explosives or incendiaries. You are here precisely to prevent that sort of thing. Take your helmets and come to the front of the car, or I'll throw the whole lot of you overboard." We didn't wait for him to repeat himself, and despite the cold which bit into our faces, we took up the positions he appointed. Laus continued forward through the loaded cars, hanging on as he moved from one to the next. He wasn't really a bully, but a man with a clear idea of a job to be done. I never saw him try to make things easier for himself, which is probably why I felt he must have a sympathetic streak, although I hadn't yet spoken to him. None of the other Feldwebels in the company were so strict. They claimed to be saving themselves for the big job, but when the moment came, Laus did as much as they, if not more. He was the oldest of the sergeants. Perhaps he had already been at the front. In fact, he was like every sergeant major in the world, afraid of responsibility, and at the same time giving us a hard time. During his tirade, he had made us realize, rightly enough, that if we couldn't stand a little cold and a vague, possible danger, we would never survive at the front. It certainly would be idiotic to get killed by some anarchist before we'd seen anything. We were rolling through a forest of squat, snow-covered pines. I had plenty of time to ponder the case of conscience the Feldwebel had put to me. The north of Poland seemed to be very sparsely populated. We had passed only a few small towns. Suddenly, well ahead of the train, I caught sight of a figure running along beside the tracks. I didn't think I could be the only person who'd noticed him, but apparently no one in any of the cars ahead was doing anything about him. Rapidly I maneuvered my Mauser into a good position, and took aim at what could only be a terrorist. Our train was moving very slowly, a perfect target for a bomb. In a few minutes I was level with the man. I couldn't see anything unusual about him. He was probably a Polish woodcutter who had come up out of curiosity. I felt disconcerted. I had been all ready to fire, and now nothing seemed to justify it. I aimed deliberately over his head and pulled the trigger. The report shook the air, and the butt of my gun crashed violently into my shoulder. The poor fellow took off as fast as he could, obviously fearing the worst, and I felt certain that my ill-considered action had made another enemy for the Reich. The train maintained its speed, and a few minutes later Laus appeared, continuing his endless patrol despite the cold. He gave me a curious look. We had decided to take duty in shifts. While two of us watched, the third would try to warm up under the canvas. We had now been on the train for something like 8 hours, and felt apprehensive about the night, which would undoubtedly be spent in these conditions. 20 minutes ago I had taken Halsey's place, and for 20 minutes had been unable to control my violent shivering. Night was drawing close, perhaps Minsk was too. The train was moving along the only track. To the north and to the south we were enclosed by dark forest. For the last quarter of an hour the train had been accelerating, which would undoubtedly result in our deaths by freezing. We had also consumed a large part of our rations to keep warm. Suddenly the train slowed down. The brake blocks grated against the wheels, and the couplings shook violently. We were soon moving at the speed of a bicycle. I saw the front of the train turn to the right. We were diverting onto a secondary track. The train moved forward for another 5 minutes, and then stopped. Two officers had jumped down from one of the front cars and were walking back. Laus and two other non-coms went out to meet them. They conferred for a moment but didn't tell us anything. All along the train people were looking out. The forest seemed a likely haven for terrorists. Our train had been standing still for several minutes when we heard the distant sound of wheels. We were walking up and down trying to warm ourselves up when a blast from a whistle accompanied by gestures indicated that we should return to our posts at once. A locomotive appeared in the distance on the track we had just left. It was entirely blacked out. What I saw next froze me with horror. I wish I were a writer of genius so that I could do justice to the vision which appeared before us. First we saw a car loaded with railway materials, pushed along in front of the locomotive and hiding its dim lights. Then came the smoking locomotive, its tender, and a closed car with a hole in its roof to accommodate a short length of smoking pipe, probably the train kitchen. Behind this another car with high railings carried armed German soldiers. A twin-mounted machine gun covered the rest of the train, which consisted simply of open flat cars like ours, but loaded with a very different kind of freight. The first one of these to pass my uncomprehending eyes seemed to be carrying a confused heap of objects, which only gradually became recognizable as human bodies. Directly behind this heap other people were clinging together, crouching or standing. Each car was full to the bursting point. One of us, more informed than the others, told us in two words what we were looking at: Russian prisoners. I thought I had recognized the brown coats I had seen once before, near the castle, but it was really too dark to be sure. Hals looked at me. Except for the burning red spots made by the cold, his face was as white as a sheet. "Did you see that?" he whispered. "They've piled up their dead to shield themselves from the wind." In my stupefaction, I could only reply with something like a groan. Every car was carrying a shield of human bodies. I stood as if petrified by the horror of the sight, rolling slowly by, faces entirely drained of blood, and bare feet stiffened by death and cold. The 10th car had just passed us when something even more horrible happened. 4 or 5 bodies slid from the badly balanced load and fell to the side of the track. The funereal train didn't stop. A group of officers and non-coms from our train walked over to investigate. Driven by I don't know what element of curiosity, I jumped down from our car and went over to the officers. I saluted and asked in a faltering voice if the men were dead. An officer looked at me in astonishment and I realized that I had just abandoned my post. He must have noticed my confusion, as he didn't reprimand me. "I think so," he said sadly. "You can help your comrades bury them." Then he turned and walked away. Hals had come with me. We went back to our car to fetch shovels and began to dig a trench a short distance above the embankment. Laos and another fellow looked through the dead men's clothes to try to find some identification. I learned later that most of these poor devils had no civilian identity. Hals and I needed all our nerve to drag two of them over to the ditch without looking at them. We were covering them with dirt when the departure whistle blew. It was growing colder by the minute. I felt overcome by a vast sense of disgust. An hour later, our train passed through a double hedge of structures which, despite the absence of light, we could see were more or less destroyed. We passed another train, less sinister than the preceding one, but scarcely comforting. Its cars were marked with red crosses. Through some of the windows we could see stretchers, which must have been carrying badly wounded men. At other windows, soldiers, swathed in bandages, were waving to us. Finally, we arrived at Minsk station. Our train pulled to a stop down the whole length of a long, wide platform covered with a busy, motley crowd, armed soldiers and soldiers in fatigues, civilians, and groups of Russian prisoners cordoned in by other prisoners who wore red and white armbands and carried truncheons. These were the informers who had denounced the famous People's Commissars and were therefore anti-communist. They claimed the right of guarding their comrades, which suited our authorities very well, as no one would be more likely to get a decent day's work from the Russian prisoners. We could hear orders being given, first in German, then in Russian. A crowd of men came up to our train, and the unloading began in the lights of the trucks parked along the platform. We joined in this work, which took the better part of 2 hours, warming ourselves a little, then plunging once more into our provisions. Hals, a greedy guts, had consumed more than half his allotment in less than 2 days. We spent the night in a large building where we were able to sleep in a certain degree of comfort. The next day we were sent to a military hospital, where we were kept for 2 days and given a series of shots. Minsk was very badly damaged. There were many gutted houses and walls crosshatched by machine gun fire. Some of the streets were totally impassable, with a continuous line of shell holes and bomb craters, often more than 15 feet deep. Passageways of a sort had been made by planks and other solid objects thrown across this chaos. From time to time we gave way to a Russian woman loaded with provisions, and always followed by 4 or 5 children who stared at us with astonishingly round eyes. There were also many curious shops whose broken windows had been replaced by boards or sacks stuffed with straw. Hals, Lenson, Morven, and I went into several of these out of curiosity. There was always an array of big earthenware crocks painted in various colors, which contained either a liquid and steeping plants, dried vegetables, or a curious heavy syrup which was halfway between jam and butter. As we didn't know how to say so much as hello in Russian, we always went into these places talking among ourselves. The few Russians who were inside invariably assumed an attitude half anxious, half smiling, while the shopkeeper or proprietress would approach us with a white-lipped smile and offer us large dippers of these products, in an obvious effort to placate the fierce warriors they imagined us to be. We were often given a fine yellowish flour to mix into this syrup whose taste was far from disagreeable, somewhat reminiscent of honey. Its only discouraging aspect was a superabundance of fat. I can still see the faces of those Russians, smiling as they held out this product and pronouncing a word which sounded rather like alka. I never was sure whether this meant eat or was simply the name of the mixture. There were days when we really gorged ourselves on alka, which nonetheless did not prevent us from appearing at 11 o'clock for the official midday meal. Hals accepted everything the Russians offered him with so much politeness. Sometimes I found him quite revolting, holding out his mess tin for the largesse of these Soviet merchants as they poured into it mixtures resembling each other only in their loose, runny consistency. Sometimes his tin would hold a combination of the famous alka, cooked wheat, salt herring cut into pieces, and several other ingredients. Whatever the concoction, Hals devoured it with evident relish, like a great pig. Except for these moments of distraction seized in the intervals between our many jobs, we scarcely had time to amuse ourselves. Minsk was an important army supply center, where shipments were constantly loaded and unloaded. Life for the troops in this sector was remarkably well organized. Mail was distributed, there were films for soldiers on leave which we were not allowed to attend, libraries, and restaurants run by Russian civilians, but reserved entirely for German soldiers. The restaurants were all too expensive for me and I never went into them, but Hals, who would sacrifice anything for a good stuffing, spent all his money in these places, and a certain amount of ours. The understanding was that he would give us a detailed account of his experiences, which he adhered to faithfully, with many embellishments. We slavered with vicarious pleasure as we listened to him. We were much better fed than we had been in Poland, and were able to supplement our rations very cheaply, which we really needed to do. The cold in these opening days of December had become extremely sharp, dropping to more than 5 degrees below zero. The snow, which fell in great abundance, never melted, and in places was already over 3 feet deep. Evidently this slowed the movement of supplies to the front, and, according to troops returning from forward positions where the cold was even more bitter than at Minsk, the poor fellows were reduced to sharing rations which were already ridiculously small. Insufficient food combined with the cold produced many cases of pneumonia, frostbite, and frozen limbs. At this moment, the Reich was making an immense effort to protect its soldiers from the implacable hostility of the Russian winter. At Minsk, Kovno, and Kiev, there were enormous stores of blankets, special winter clothing made of sheepskin, overshoes with thick insulating soles and uppers of matted hair, gloves, hoods of double catskin, and portable heaters which operated equally well on gasoline, oil, or solidified alcohol. Mountains of rations in specially conditioned boxes, and thousands of other necessities. It was our duty, as convoy troops of the Royal Bane, to deliver all of this to the front lines, where the combat troops were desperately awaiting us. We made superhuman efforts, and yet they were not enough. The punishment we suffered, not at the hands of the Russian army, which until that moment had done almost nothing except retreat, but from the cold, is almost beyond the powers of description. Outside the great towns there had not yet been time to repair the damaged roads few and far between to begin with or to open others. While our unit was doing its autumn gymnastics, the Wehrmacht, after an extraordinary advance, had marched itself and its supplies into an unbelievable quagmire. Then the first frosts had solidified the monstrous ruts leading to the east. Our machines had suffered enormously on these roads, which in fact were passable only for wagons, but the hardening of the soil had temporarily allowed the provisioning of the troops. Then winter poured down its tons of snow across the immensity of Russia, once again paralyzing traffic. That is the point we had reached in December, 1942. We shoveled away snow so that our trucks could move forward 15 or 20 miles in a morning, only to find our efforts covered over again the same day. The earth beneath the snow was a sinister relief of bumps and potholes, which we tamped down or blew up. In the evenings we scrambled to find shelter for the night. Sometimes this would be a but fitted out by the engineers, sometimes an izba, a log hut or any house we could find. We often crowded more than 50 men into a but intended for a couple and two children. The most desired accommodations were the big tents especially designed for Russia.